Chapter 48. The Dappled Greys. The Baron, followed by the Count, traversed a long suite of apartments in which the prevailing characteristics were heavy magnificence and the gaudiness of ostentatious wealth, until he reached the boudoir of Madame Danglars, a small octagonal-shaped room hung with pink satin, covered with white Indian muslin. The chairs were of ancient workmanship and materials. Over the doors were painted sketches of shepherds and shepherdesses, after the style and manner of Boucher. And at each side, pretty medallions in crayons, harmonizing well with the fittings up of this charming apartment, the only one throughout the vast mansion in which any distinctive taste prevailed. The truth was, it had been entirely overlooked in the plan arranged and followed out by Monsieur Danglars and his architect, who had been selected to aid the Baron in the great work of improvement he meditated, solely because he was the most fashionable and celebrated decorator of the day. The ornamental part of the fittings-up of Madame Danglars' boudoir had then been left entirely to herself and Lucien Debray. Monsieur Danglars, however, while possessing a great admiration for the antique, as it was understood during the time of the Directory, entertained the most sovereign contempt for the simple elegance of his wife's favourite sitting-room, where, by the way, he was never permitted to intrude, unless, indeed, he excused his own appearance by ushering in some more agreeable visitor than himself, and even then he had rather the air and manner of a person who was himself introduced than as being the presenter of another, his reception being either cordial or frigid in proportion as the individual who accompanied him chanced to please or displease his lady wife. As Danglars now entered, he found Madame la Baronne, who, although past the first bloom of youth, was still strikingly handsome, seated at the piano, a most elaborate piece of cabinet and inlaid work, while Lucien Debray, standing before a small work-table, was turning over the pages of an album. Lucien had found time, preparatory to the Count's arrival, to relate many particulars respecting him to Madame Danglars. It will be remembered that Monte Cristo had made a lively impression on the minds of all the party assembled at the breakfast given by Albert de Morcerf, and although Debray was not in the habit of yielding to such feelings, he had never been able to shake off the powerful influence excited in his mind by the impressive look and manner of the Count. Consequently, the description given by Lucien to the Baroness bore the highly coloured tinge of his own heated imagination. Already excited by the wonderful stories related of the Count by de Morcerf, it is no wonder that Madame Danglars eagerly listened to and fully credited all the additional circumstances detailed by Debray. The sound of approaching footsteps compelled the animated pair to assume an appearance of calm indifference and worldly ease. The lady flew to her piano, and her companion snatched up an album which fortunately lay near, and seemed as though really interested in its contents. A most gracious welcome and unusual smile were bestowed on Monsieur Danglars. The Count, in return for his gentlemanly bow, received a formal though graceful curtsy, while Lucien exchanged with the Count a sort of distant recognition, and with Danglars a free and easy nod.
"Baroness," said Danglars, "give me leave to present to you the Count of Monte Cristo, who has been most warmly recommended to me by my correspondents at Rome. I need but mention one fact to make all the ladies in Paris court his notice, and that is that the noble individual before you has come to take up his abode in our fine capital for 1 year, during which brief period he proposes to spend 6 millions of money. Think of that. It sounds very much like an announcement of balls, fêtes, dinners and picnic parties, in all of which I trust Monsieur le Comte will remember us, as he may depend upon it we shall remember him in all the entertainments we may give, be they great or small."
In spite of the gross flattery and coarseness of this address, Madame Danglars could not forbear gazing with considerable interest on a man capable of expending 6 millions in 12 months, and who had selected Paris for the scene of his princely extravagance.
"And when did you arrive here?"
inquired she. "Yesterday morning, madame."
"Coming, as usual, I presume, from the extreme end of the globe? Pardon me. At least such, I have heard, is your custom."
"Nay, madame. This time I have merely proceeded from Cadiz hither."
"You have selected a most unfavourable moment for your first visit to our city. Paris is a horrible place in the summer. Balls, parties, and fêtes are over. The Italian opera is in London, the French opera everywhere except at Paris. As for the Théâtre Français, you know, of course, that it is nowhere. The only amusement left us are the indifferent races held in the Champ de Mars and Sartori. Do you propose entering any horses at either of these races, Monsieur le Comte?"
"I assure you, madame," replied Monte Cristo, "my present intentions are to do whatever will tend to render my sojourn in Paris most agreeable to myself and others. I only pray I may find some kind, pitying friend who will commiserate my lamentable ignorance of such matters and instruct me rightly to understand the habits and etiquette of this polished city.
Are you fond of horses, Monsieur le Comte?"
"I have passed a considerable part of my life in the East, madame, and you are doubtless aware that the inhabitants of those climes value only two things, the fine breeding of their horses and the beauty of their females."
"Nay, Monsieur le Comte," said the baroness, "it would have been somewhat more gallant to have placed the ladies before the animals."
"You see, madame, how rightly I spoke when I said I required a preceptor to guide me in all my sayings and doings here." At this instant, the favourite attendant of Madame Danglars entered the boudoir. Approaching her mistress, she spoke some words in an undertone. Madame Danglars turned very pale, then exclaimed,
"I cannot believe it! The thing is impossible!"
"I assure you, madame," replied the woman, "it is even as I have said."
Turning impatiently towards her husband, Madame Danglars demanded,
"Is this true?"
"Is what true, madame?" inquired Danglars, visibly agitated.
"That when my coachman was about to prepare my carriage, he discovered that the horses had been removed from the stables without his knowledge? I desire to know what is the meaning of this."
"Be kind enough, madame, to listen to me," said Danglars.
"Fear not my listening. Aye, and attentively too, for in truth I am most curious to hear what explanation you propose offering for conduct so unparalleled. These two gentlemen shall decide between us, but first I will state the case to them. Gentlemen," continued the baroness, "among the 10 horses in the stables of Monsieur le Baron Danglars are 2 that belong exclusively to me, a pair of the handsomest and most spirited creatures to be found in Paris. But to you, at least, Monsieur de Bray, I need not give a further description, because to you my beautiful pair of dappled greys were well known. Well, I had promised Madame de Villefort the loan of my carriage to drive tomorrow to the Bois de Boulogne, but when my coachman goes to fetch the greys from the stables, they are gone, positively gone. No doubt Monsieur Danglars has sacrificed them to the selfish consideration of gaining some thousands of paltry francs. Oh, how I hate and detest that money-grasping nature! Heaven defend me from all the race of mercenary speculators!"
"Madame," replied Danglars, "the horses were not sufficiently quiet for you. They were scarcely 4 years old, and they made me extremely uneasy on your account."
"Nonsense," retorted the baroness. "You could not have entertained any alarm on the subject, because you are perfectly well aware that I have recently engaged a coachman who is said to be the best in Paris. But perhaps you have disposed of the coachman, as well as the horses."
"My dear love, pray do not say any more about them, and I promise you another pair exactly like them in appearance, only more quiet and steady."
The baroness shrugged up her shoulders with an air of ineffable contempt, while her husband, affecting not to observe it, turned towards Monte Cristo and said,
"Upon my word, Monsieur le Comte, I am quite sorry I was not sooner aware of your establishing yourself in Paris."
"And wherefore?" asked the Count.
"Because I should have liked to have made you the offer of these horses. I have almost given them away as it is, but as I before said, I was anxious to get rid of them upon any terms. They were only fit for a young man, not at all calculated for a person at my time of life."
"I am much obliged by your kind intentions towards me," said Monte Cristo. "But this morning I purchased a very excellent pair of carriage horses, and I do not think they were dear. There they are. Come, Monsieur de Bray, you are a connoisseur, I believe. Let me have your opinion upon them." As de Bray walked towards the window, Danglars approached his wife.
"I could not tell you before others," said he in a low tone, "the reason of my parting with the horses, but a most enormous price was offered me this morning for them. Some madman or fool, bent upon ruining himself as fast as he can, actually sent his steward to me to purchase them at any cost. And the fact is, I have gained 16,000 francs by the sale of them." "Come, don't look so angry, and you shall have 4,000 francs of the money to do what you like with, and Eugenie shall have 2,000. There, what do you think now of the affair? Wasn't I right to part with the horses?"
Madame Danglars surveyed her husband with a look of withering contempt.
"What do I see?"
suddenly exclaimed de Bray.
"Where?"
asked the baroness.
"I cannot be mistaken. There are your horses, the very animals we were speaking of, harnessed to the Count's carriage. My dear, beautiful, dappled greys,
demanded the Baroness, springing to the window.
"'Tis indeed they!' said she.
Danglars looked absolutely stultified. "'How very singular!' cried Monte Cristo, with well-feigned astonishment. Madame Danglars whispered a few words in the ear of Debray, who approached Monte Cristo, saying,
"'The Baroness wishes to know what you paid her husband for the horses.'
"'I scarcely know,' replied the Count. "'It was a little surprise prepared for me by my steward. "'He knew how desirous I was of meeting with precisely such a pair of horses, "'and so he bought them. "'I think, if I remember rightly, "'he hinted that he had given somewhere about 30,000 francs.'
"'Debray conveyed the Count's reply to the Baroness. "'Poor Danglars looked so crestfallen and discomfited "'that Monte Cristo assumed a pitying air towards him.'
"'See,' said the Count, "'how very ungrateful women are. "'Your kind attention in providing for the safety of the Baroness "'by disposing of the horses "'does not seem to have made the least impression on her. "'But so it is. "'A woman will often, from mere wilfulness, "'prefer that which is dangerous to that which is safe. "'Therefore, in my opinion, my dear Baron, "'the best and easiest way is to leave them to their fancies "'and allow them to act as they please, "'and then if any mischief follows, "'why, at least they have no one to blame but themselves.'
Danglars made no reply. He was occupied in anticipation of the coming scene between himself and the Baroness, whose threatening looks and frowning brow, like that of Olympic Jove, predicted a fearful storm. Debray, who perceived the gathering clouds and felt no desire to witness the explosion of Madame Danglars' rage, suddenly recollected an appointment which compelled him to take his leave, while Monte Cristo, unwilling to destroy the advantages he hoped to obtain by prolonging his stay, made a farewell bow and departed, leaving Danglars to endure the angry reproaches of his wife.
"Excellent," murmured Monte Cristo to himself, as he retraced the way to his carriage. "All has gone according to my wishes. The domestic peace of this family is henceforth in my hands. Now then, to play another masterstroke by which I shall gain the heart of both husband and wife. Delightful. Still," added he, "amid all this I have not yet been presented to Mademoiselle Eugénie Danglars, whose acquaintance I should have been glad to make. But never mind," pursued he, with that peculiar smile that at times lighted up his countenance, "it matters not for the present. I am on the spot, and have plenty of time before me. By and by will do for that part of my scheme." The Count's further meditations were interrupted by his arrival at his own abode. 2 hours afterwards, Madame Danglars received a most flattering epistle from the Count, in which he entreated her to receive back her favourite dappled greys, protesting that he could not endure the idea of making his debut in the Parisian world of fashion with the knowledge that his splendid equipage had been obtained at the price of a lovely woman's regrets. The horses were sent back, wearing the same harness they had done in the morning. The only difference consisted in the rosettes worn on the heads of the animals being adorned with a large diamond placed in the centre of each by order of the Count. To Danglars, Monte Cristo also wrote, requesting him to excuse the whimsical gift of a capricious millionaire, and to beg of Madame la Baronne to pardon the Eastern fashion adopted in the return of the horses. During the evening, Monte Cristo quitted Paris for Auteuil, accompanied by Ali. The following day, about 3 o'clock, a single blow struck on the gong summoned Ali to the presence of the Count. "Ali," observed his master, as the Nubian entered the chamber, "you have frequently explained to me how more than commonly skilful you are in throwing the lasso, have you not?" Ali drew himself up proudly, and then returned a sign in the affirmative. "I thought I did not mistake. With your lasso, could you stop an ox?" Again Ali repeated his affirmative gesture. "Or a tiger?" Ali bowed his head in token of assent. "A lion, even?" Ali sprung forwards, imitating the action of one throwing the lasso, then of a strangled lion. "I understand," said Monte Cristo, "you wish to tell me you have hunted the lion." Ali smiled with triumphant pride, as he signified that he had indeed both chased and captured many lions. "But do you believe you could arrest the progress of 2 horses, rushing forwards with ungovernable fury?" The Nubian smiled. "It is well," said Monte Cristo. "Then listen to me. Ere long a carriage will dash past here, drawn by the pair of dappled grey horses you saw me with yesterday. Now, at the risk of your own life, you must manage to stop those horses before my door." Ali descended to the street, and marked a straight line on the pavement immediately at the entrance of the house, and then pointed out the line he had traced to the Count, who was watching him.
The Count patted him gently on the back. His usual mode of praising Ali, who, pleased and gratified with the commission assigned him, walked calmly towards a projecting stone forming the angle of the street and house, and, seating himself thereon, began to smoke his chibouk, while Monte Cristo re-entered his dwelling, perfectly assured of the success of his plan. Still, as 5 o'clock approached, and the carriage was momentarily expected by the Count, the indication of more than common impatience and uneasiness might be observed in his manner. He stationed himself in a room, commanding a view of the street, pacing the chamber with restless steps, stopping merely to listen from time to time for the sound of approaching wheels, then to cast an anxious glance on Ali. But the regularity with which the Nubian puffed forth the smoke of his chibouk proved that he at least was wholly absorbed in the enjoyment of his favourite occupation. Suddenly a distant sound of rapidly advancing wheels was heard, and almost immediately a carriage appeared, drawn by a pair of wild, ungovernable horses, who rushed forward as though urged by the fiend himself, while the terrified coachman strove in vain to restrain their furious speed. In the vehicle was a female, apparently young, and a child of about 7 or 8 years of age. Terror seemed to have deprived them even of the power of uttering a cry, and both were clasped in each other's arms, as though determined not to be parted by death itself. The carriage creaked and rattled as it flew over the rough stones, and had it encountered the slightest impediment to its progress, it must inevitably have upset. But it still flew on, and the cries of the affrighted spectators testified the universal sense of the imminent peril its occupants were threatened with. Then Ali knew the right moment was come, and throwing down his chibouk, he drew the lasso from his pocket, threw it so skilfully as to catch the forelegs of the near horse in its triple fold, suffering himself to be dragged on for a few steps, by which time the tightening of the well-cast lasso had so completely hampered the furious animal as to bring it to the ground, and falling on the pole it snapped, and therefore prevented the other animal from pursuing its headlong way. Gladly availing himself of this opportunity, the coachman leapt from his box, but Ali had promptly seized the nostrils of the second horse and held them in his iron grasp, till the maddened beast, snorting with pain, sunk beside his companion. All this was achieved in much less time than is occupied in the recital. The brief space had, however, been sufficient for an individual, followed by a number of servants, to rush from the house before which the accident had occurred. And as the coachman opened the door of the carriage to take from it a lady who was convulsively grasping the cushions with one hand, while with the other she pressed to her bosom her young companion, who had lost all consciousness of what was passing. Monte Cristo carried them both to the salon, and deposited them on a sofa. "Compose yourself, madame," said he. "All danger is over." The female looked up at these words, and with a glance far more expressive than any entreaties could have been, pointed to her child, who still continued insensible. "I understand the nature of your alarms, madame," said the Count, carefully examining the child, "but I assure you there is not the slightest occasion for uneasiness. Your little charge has not received the least injury. His insensibility is merely the effects of terror, and will soon cease."
"Are you quite sure you do not say so to tranquillize my fears? See how deadly pale he is. My child, my darling Edward, speak to your mother. Open your dear eyes and look on me once again. Oh, sir, in pity send for help. My whole fortune shall not be thought too much for the recovery of my blessed boy."
With a calm smile and gentle wave of the hand, Monte Cristo signed to the distracted mother to lay aside her apprehensions. Then opening a casket that stood near, he drew forth a phial composed of Bohemian glass containing a liquid of the colour of blood, of which he let fall a single drop on the child's lips. Scarcely had it reached them, ere the boy, though still pale as marble, opened his eyes and eagerly gazed around him. At this unhoped-for sight, the wild delight of the mother equalled her former despair.
"Where am I?"
exclaimed she, when her first raptures at her son's recovery were past.
"And to whom am I indebted for so happy a termination to my late dreadful alarm?"
"Madame," answered the Count, "you are under the roof of one who esteems himself most fortunate in having been able to save you from a further continuance of your sufferings."
"My wretched curiosity has brought all this about," pursued the lady. "All Paris rung with the praises of Madame Danglars' beautiful horses, and I had the folly to desire to know whether they really merited the high character given of them."
"Is it possible," exclaimed the Count, with well-feigned astonishment, "that these horses belong to Madame la Baronne?"
"They do indeed. May I inquire if you are acquainted with Madame Danglars?"
I have that honour, and my happiness at your escape from the danger that threatened you is redoubled by the consciousness that I have been the unwilling and unintentional cause of all the peril you have incurred. I, yesterday, purchased these horses of the Baron, but as the Baroness evidently regretted parting with them, I ventured to send them back to her, with a request that she would gratify me by accepting them from my hands.
You are then, doubtless, the Count of Monte Cristo, of whom Hermine has talked to me so much.
You have rightly guessed, Madame, replied the Count.
And I am Madame Heloise de Villefort.
The Count bowed with the air of a person who hears a name for the first time.
How grateful will Monsieur de Villefort be for all your goodness! How thankfully will he acknowledge that to you alone it is owing that his wife and child exist! Most certainly, but for the prompt assistance of your intrepid servant, this dear child and myself must both have perished.
Indeed, I still shudder at the recollection of the fearful danger you were placed in, as well as your interesting child.
I trust you will not object to my offering a recompense to your noble-hearted servant, proportionate to the service he has rendered me and mine.
I beseech you, madame, replied Monte Cristo, not to spoil Ali, either by too great praise or rewards. I cannot allow him to acquire the habit of expecting to be recompensed for every trifling service he may render. Ali is my slave, and in saving your life he was but discharging his duty to me.
Nay,
interposed Madame de Villefort, on whom the authoritative style adopted by the Count made a deep impression.
Nay, but consider that to preserve my life he has risked his own.
His life, madame, belongs not to him. It is mine, in return for my having myself saved him from death. Madame de Villefort made no further reply. Her mind was utterly absorbed in the contemplation of the singular individual who, from the first instant of her beholding him, had made so powerful an impression on her. During the evident preoccupation of Madame de Villefort, Monte Cristo scrutinized the features and appearance of the boy she kept folded in her arms, lavishing on him the most tender endearments. The child was small for his age and unnaturally pale. A mass of straight black hair, defying all attempts to train or curl it, fell over his projecting forehead and hung down to his shoulders, giving increased vivacity to eyes already sparkling with a youthful love of mischief and fondness for every forbidden enjoyment. His mouth was large, and the lips, which had not yet regained their colour, were particularly thin. In fact, the deep and crafty look, forming the principal character of the child's face, belonged rather to a boy of 12 or 14 years of age than to one so young. His first movement was to free himself by a violent push from the encircling arms of his mother, and to rush forwards to the casket from whence the Count had taken the phial of elixir. Then, without asking permission of any one, he proceeded in all the wilfulness of a spoiled child unaccustomed to restrain either whims or caprices, to pull the corks out of all the bottles in the casket. "Touch nothing, my little friend," cried the Count eagerly. "Some of those liquids are not only dangerous to taste, but even to smell." Madame de Villefort became very pale, and seizing her son's arm drew him anxiously towards her, but once satisfied of his safety she also cast a brief but expressive glance on the casket, which was not lost upon the Count. At this moment Ali entered. At sight of him, Madame de Villefort uttered an expression of pleasure, and holding the child still closer towards her, she said,
"Edward, dearest, do you see that good man? He has shown very great courage and resolution, for he exposed his own life to stop the horses that were running away with us, and would certainly have dashed the carriage to pieces ere long. Thank him, then, my child, in your very best manner, for had he not come to our aid, neither you nor I would have been alive to speak our thanks."
This address, however, excited no similar feeling of gratitude on the part of the child, who, instead of obeying his mother's directions, stuck out his lips and turned away his head in a disdainful and contemptuous manner, saying,
"I don't like him. He's too ugly for me."
The Count witnessed all this with internal satisfaction, and a smile stole over his features as he thought that such a child bade fair to realize one part of his hopes, while Madame de Villefort reprimanded her son with a gentleness and moderation very far from conveying the least idea of a fault having been committed. "This lady," said the Count, speaking to Ali in the Arabic language, "is desirous that her son should thank you for saving both their lives, but the boy refuses, saying, 'You are too ugly.'"
Ali turned his intelligent countenance towards the boy, on whom he gazed without any apparent emotion, but the sort of spasmodic working of the nostrils showed to the practised eye of Monte Cristo how deeply the Arab was wounded by the unfeeling remark.
"Will you permit me to inquire," said Madame de Villefort, as she rose to take her leave, "whether you usually reside here?"
"No, I do not," replied Monte Cristo. "It is a small place I have purchased quite lately. My place of abode is number 30 Avenue des Champs-Élysées. But I am delighted to see your countenance seems expressive of a perfect return to tranquillity. You have quite recovered from your fright, and are, no doubt, desirous of returning home. Anticipating your wishes, I have desired the same horses you came with to be put to one of my carriages, and Ali, he whom you think so very ugly," continued he, addressing the boy with a smiling air, "will have the honour of driving you home, while your coachman remains here to attend to the necessary repairs of your calèche. Directly that important business is concluded, I will have a couple of my own horses harnessed to convey it direct to Madame Danglars."
"I dare not return with those dreadful horses," said Madame de Villefort.
"You will see," replied Monte Cristo, "that they will be as different as possible in the hands of Ali. With him they will be gentle and docile as lambs." Ali had indeed given proof of this, for approaching the animals, who had been got upon their legs with considerable difficulty, he rubbed their foreheads and nostrils with a sponge soaked in aromatic vinegar, and wiped off the sweat and foam that covered their mouths. Then, commencing a loud whistling noise, he rubbed them well all over their bodies for several minutes, and, undisturbed by the noisy crowd collected round the broken carriage, Ali quietly harnessed the pacified animals to the Count's chariot, took the reins in his hands, and mounted the box, when, lo, to the utter astonishment of those who had witnessed the ungovernable spirit and maddened velocity of the same horses, he was actually compelled to apply his whip in no very gentle manner ere he could induce them to start, and even then all that could be obtained from the celebrated dappled greys, now changed into a couple of as dull, sluggish, stupid brutes as the most timid driver would desire to meet with, was a slow, pottering pace, kept up with so much difficulty that Madame de Villefort was more than a couple of hours returning to her residence in the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. Scarcely had the first congratulations upon her miraculous escape been gone through than she retired to her room, ostensibly for the purpose of seeking a little repose, but in reality to write the following letter to Madame Danglars.
"Dear Hermine, I have just had a wonderful escape from the most imminent danger, and I owe my safety to the very Count of Monte Cristo we were talking about yesterday, but whom I little expected to see today. I remember how unmercifully I laughed at what I considered your eulogistic and exaggerated praises of him, but I have now ample cause to admit that your enthusiastic description of this wonderful man fell far short of his merits. But I must endeavour to render the account of my adventures somewhat more intelligible. You must know, then, my dear friend, that when I had proceeded with your horses as far as Ranelagh, they darted forwards like mad things, and galloped away at so fearful a rate that there seemed no other prospect for myself and my poor Edward but that of being dashed to pieces against the first object that impeded their progress, when a strange-looking man, an Arab or a Nubian, at least a black of some nation or other, at a signal from the Count, whose domestic he is, suddenly seized and stopped the infuriated animals, even at the risk of being trampled to death himself, and certainly he must have had a most wonderful escape. The Count then hastened to us, and carried myself and son into his house, where, by some skilful application, he speedily recalled my poor Edward, who was quite insensible from terror, to life. When we were sufficiently recovered, he sent us home in his own carriage. Yours will be returned to you tomorrow. I am fearful you will not be able to use your horses for some days. They seem thoroughly stupefied, as if sulky and vexed at having allowed this black servant to conquer them after all. The Count, however, has commissioned me to assure you that 2 or 3 days' rest, with plenty of barley for their sole food during that time, will bring them back to their former fine condition, which means, I suppose, that they will be ready to run off with a carriage again, and play their wild pranks with as much headstrong fury as they evinced yesterday. Do not let them endanger your life, dear Hermine, as they did mine, for Providence may not send a Monte Cristo or his Nubian servant to preserve you from destruction, as it did me. Adieu.
I cannot return you many thanks for the drive of yesterday, but after all I ought not to blame you for the misconduct of your horses, more especially as it procured me the pleasure of an introduction to the Count of Monte Cristo. And certainly that illustrious individual, apart from the millions he is said to be so very anxious to dispose of, seemed to me one of those curiously interesting problems which I, for one, delight in solving at any risk or danger. Nay, so bent am I on following up my acquaintance with this remarkable personage, that if all other means fail, I really believe I shall have to borrow your horses again and make another excursion to the Bois de Boulogne. My sweet Edward endured the accident with admirable courage. He did not utter a single cry, but fell lifeless into my arms, nor did a tear fall from his eyes after it was over. I doubt not you will consider these praises the result of blind maternal affection, but the delicate, fragile form of my beloved child contains a mind of no ordinary strength, with a heroic firmness of a Spartan boy. Valentine sends many affectionate remembrances to your dear Eugenie, and with best love to her and yourself, I remain ever yours truly, Heloise de Villefort. P.S. Do pray contrive some means for my meeting the Count of Monte Cristo at your house. I must and will see him again. I have just made Monsieur de Villefort promise to call on him, in order to acknowledge the signal service he has rendered our family in preserving our child, if my unworthy self goes for nothing, and I flatter myself my husband's visit will be returned by the Count.
Nothing was talked of throughout the evening but the adventure at Auteuil. Albert related it to his mother, Chateau Renaud recounted it at the Jockey Club, and Debray detailed it at length in the salons of the minister. Even Beauchamp accorded 20 lines in his journal to the relation of the Count's courage and gallantry, thereby placing him as the greatest hero of the day before the eyes of all the fair members of the aristocracy of France. Vast was the crowd of visitors and inquiring friends who left their names at the hotel of Madame de Villefort, with a design of renewing their visit at the right moment, of hearing from her lips all the interesting circumstances of this most romantic adventure. As Heloise had stated, Monsieur de Villefort donned his best black suit, drew on a pair of new white kid gloves, ordered the servants to attend the carriage dressed in their full livery, and forthwith drove to the hotel of the Count, situated, as the reader is already informed, in the Avenue des Champs-Élysées.